Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. I'm half of your host, Nicholas Glarmer, joined, of course, today, as always, by...
A barking dog in the background. Oh, no, hold on. That's not me.
Apologies, my dog is very excited by something completely meaningless.
I'm Gabriel Krauser, and I am feeling slightly excited by things that are very meaningful, I hope. Well, is that too much?
No, that's always good.
Yeah, today started out with the glorious journey to the newspaper store, to the corner cafe, to see if...
What's that report?
There we saw a piece on the cover of their sort of analysis section and a two-page full spread inside of that, arguing that racism is not the problem, that most South Africans know this, and that we need to get real about our problems so that we can solve them. And yeah, it's part of this campaign that we've been building up, and the billboards are up and the website's going, and another video is going up today. So feeling excited about that on a fresh, brisk Sunday. www.racismisnottheproblem.co.za.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
It's nice when things work out. And we've got some pieces that we've sort of commissioned from outsiders to get various takes on this. And some of them have been coming in over the weekend. It's been a pleasure to read. We look forward to sharing that as well.
Yeah. Very good. Exciting stuff. Well, hopefully not. Someone of the racism is the problem crowd will get very upset and say something about it, which I think would be a good thing.
That is the next step. We're missing out on my slightly false dichotomy, provocative dichotomy, I think useful to a point, is that on the one side you've got the racism is not the problem crowd, and on the other side you have the everywhere racism crowd.
Right.
And, of course, we can meet on the common ground of like, no, sometimes racism is a problem and you must definitely address that. But our view is, much like asking a fish if it's wet, it doesn't really work if everything is wet. You have to sort of see that it's not the general problem to see when it is, in fact, in a particular instance,
a problem. It's that old maxim, if you defend everywhere, then you defend nowhere, right?
Yeah. Wasn't that the argument against the war on terror? That it's a war on all fronts?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the war on terror was the war on everyone who the Bush administration believed was a problem at the time. And they just couldn't come up with a nice way of saying that. So that's why they went with terror. And I say this as a bloodthirsty, warmongering neocon coward who is strangely supportive of some of those things. But anyway, that's not the point. So what were we going to talk about today?
Nick needs to start us off with a short but very interesting development from the greatest citadel of power on the planet.
Right. So as some of our listeners may be aware, and some may literally not be aware, there is a theory out there at the moment that Donald Trump is going to be found, that the election is going to be found to be fraudulent, and that Donald Trump, along with two senators, are going to be reinstated into their positions and resume their role. So Donald Trump will become president and the two Republican senators will take up their seats in the Senate. Now,
in August.
And
this is not just a theory that it'll happen sometime in the future. It's going to happen now. Just now.
Right.
How do we say it in South Africa?
Right. So, you know, I we have been through this before. And I know that some people have gotten upset about us about it, but we do not believe that there was vote fraud of the scale to change the result of the election in the United States. And that's the first problem with this theory. But the second problem with this theory is that there is no reinstatement process. So even if it did in fact emerge,
It won't. But even if it did.
But even if it emerged that a that the president had been completely hard done by, and the system had been rigged, and it was the greatest attack on democracy in America's history. There is no reinstatement process. So then, you know, there would have to be an impeachment or something like that, which wouldn't happen.
Okay, so there's two problems with the theory that you've already identified. There's a third problem with the theory, which is that it seems like a crazy conspiracy theory coming out of the New York Times, which just wants to make fun of Donald Trump and make it seem like he's still important when he isn't, and make it seem like he's crazy when he's not really that crazy. We really trust the New York Times to say anything about Donald Trump?
So I think it was Maggie Haberman from the New York Times. She writes this piece and she says, Donald Trump believes that this theory that I've just talked about is going to be the thing, is going to happen. This is his genuine belief. Now, there have been, as Gabriel is happy to point out, there is an enormous number of garbage stories about Trump that have come out over the past 4 years. All these badly sourced stories just filled with kind of unsubstantiated nonsense, anonymous sources, reasons that you really shouldn't take them seriously, right? And yet, Charlie Cook, who is a, you know, he's not a super Trump-friendly dude, but he's a right-wing guy. He writes for the National Review. I think he voted for Trump. He lives in Florida. He's a really, I think he's a really solid, up-and-down-the-line kind of dude who's not wont to lie. Says that he was certain that this was garbage, so he knows some people in the Florida Republicans who are, of course, close to Trump at the moment because that's where Trump is living. And he confirms that as for the evidence he's seen, it does seem that Trump does, in fact, believe this theory.
Which, yeah. So Trump really believes he's going to be president in August. The moon is made of cheese. And
yeah, so, I mean, I really hope it's not true, but I kind of trust Charlie Cook. So I don't feel very good about this. This doesn't seem like it will end well.
It doesn't. And I think that we, at least I sit in this interesting position where I wouldn't have voted for Trump in 2016 because I was just too afraid of him chanting lock her up and telling his crowd to beat people. But I was delightfully surprised at a lot of his presidency. Think there were some good reforms. Good foreign policy moves under Pompeo, some embarrassing stuff, but not nearly the threat to democracy that I thought it would be. Kids in cages was this sort of moral, terrible thing that Trump had done. It turned out that that was something of a hangover from the previous administration, which had just increased. You know, I don't know. I felt like I could see through a lot of the anti-Trump nonsense, the Trump derangement syndrome. And I felt like I could also see through some of the Trump derangement syndrome that was super for him, that sort of made it seem as if he was playing four-dimensional chess. And then when the Capitol Hill was invaded and he responded, I'm not so concerned that he said, you're lovely people, but I'm very concerned that he didn't say you must stop this now and that this never should have happened and that you should never do it again and this is completely unthinkable and not worth it and terrible, terrible, terrible. He just sort of failed to use his place of influence to stop a very serious attack on American democracy. That and his commitment to the big lie theory that there was such widespread election fraud that the results actually would have been in his favor were it not for that. Despite all of the evidence coming into the contrary, not that there was no election fraud at all, not that there was nothing worrying about the way that the system was run, but certainly the evidence as it came in showed that that was wrong. The fact that he's sort of kept with these two things has changed my mind again. Now I'm back in the position where I really, really, really see him as a dangerous threat, not only to American society, but to the world, especially because a significant minority of Americans will follow him off the edge of a cliff if he says that on the other side is milk and honey. I now worry even more. The Biden administration seems to be pulling in the wrong direction. $6 trillion worth of printing. The Trump side seems to be pulling in the wrong direction. The middle ground seems to be increasingly resigned to the lunatics that are currently running the asylum.
Yeah, no, it does seem to be the case. Really doesn't feel like there's any particularly good options for America at the moment. But, you know, We'll have to see. Anyway, we didn't want to focus too much on this today. It's just something to read about. If you don't believe us, do go and check it out for yourself. I'm sure you may be interested to read more about this.
Yeah. What we really want to do today is talk about history, right? So,
oh yeah,
little bit of revisionist history. There's this nice line that Chairman Mao had that sort of ranked society on how terrible you were because of how infected you were by bourgeois values. And historians he considered to be, I think, the second lowest or lowest class. sort of pig swine that feed on mushrooms in the dark and then only produce more fecal matter. And they must sort of have their reading glasses ground into dust and their elbows shattered at the wheel of rural agriculture so that they can learn what really needs to be learned. And so they're all revisionists. Now, in a sense, he's right, of course. History is a process of revising our previous understandings of the present.
Right.
And revisionist history, when it's a cuss term, means you're revising it in order to mythologize your way into a new position of influence or something like that. But the good side of it is just saying, you know, okay, here we had an appraisal. It was good on this front, bad on this front. Here we have a new appraisal. And so I think we want to talk about
in the way revisionist history is often used, it's very often used as a kind of a shorthand for left-wing reviews of history to make it seem like the left was always right about whatever the question is.
Yeah. And there's some right-wing stuff as well, I'm sure. Although I don't know it as
well. No, there is. I'm not saying that it's, but I'm just saying when it's properly used as a term of abuse.
Oh no, but it's also used by the left. Oh, if you're a revisionist, you know, if someone says colonialism wasn't only a bad thing,
right,
or that its legacy had some positive effects, I say, you're being a revisionist of history. You're being an apartheid apologist. Or so what we want to do is kind of focus on two figures. One. Kaiser Wilhelm II, who I think if people know anything about him, probably think he was a pretty bad hombre. And the other, Jan Smuts, who I think some people hold in pretty high regard, especially some classical liberals. And some people sort of consider to be evil incarnate because he was just another white leader of a white supremacist South Africa where black people weren't allowed to vote or to own land or do business or reside in most of the country. And that's all true. But what we want to do, what I want to sort of make this argument about Smuts and really I'll sort of lead with the conclusion. The conclusion is I think that the best historical analog of Ramaphosa's presidency is Smuts's presidency. And that a lot of people's attitudes towards Ramaphosa would be well applied towards Smuts. But I'll justify that. But let's start out with Kaiser Wilhelm II. So bad guy or secretly kind of a good guy?
Right. So Kaiser Wilhelm II, I'm not as familiar with his early life, but basically he comes to the throne and he, as far as I'm concerned, he makes one of the biggest mistakes in German history, which is that he fires Otto von Bismarck, because Otto von Bismarck, who has been the very influential, very powerful chancellor of Germany for the past couple of years, has reshaped Europe, has...
Past couple of decades.
Decades. Has founded Germany, I mean, like, pretty much literally. And Kaiser Wilhelm II, who's now, you know, the emperor of this new German state that has come into being, says, oh, well, you know, you're actually a little bit too powerful and you're a bit too old and you've been there too long. So out you go. Chucks him out. Okay, so you know, whatever. That's that. If that was the only thing he did in his life.
And by the way, part of the reason that he felt he could do this because Bismarck was super popular. I mean, Germany's founded somewhere in the 1860s, 1870s. It was a relatively young country, and because Bismarck is the Iron Chancellor who sort of has rapid defeats, he beats France very, very quickly. That gives him military prestige. He then unifies the country, makes sure that Austria is not part of Germany, doesn't try and do this race nationalist thing of all Germans or all Teutons must be under one country. Instead, goes with sort of Wilhelm Gottlieb Herder's idea of like building a new cultural identity that is about ritual and music and achievement rather than immutable characteristics, which is basic language. Makes him very, very popular. And
also helps to set up the first welfare state, partly as a way of making sure that the people don't clamor for democracy.
Yeah, so he kind of he old age grants, some healthcare, really popular stuff. It's really good. Really
popular, yeah.
Also has this curious thing where of all the major power European leaders, he's the only one who's passionately against colonialism, which is part of the reason that the main colonial conferences that people all know about, 1884, 1885 Berlin conference, are hosted in Germany. Because between the French and the Brits, the Portuguese, the Spanish, and the Russians to an extent,
right. All of them have
everyone is very keen on accruing power, whereas the Germans have clapped France and could have taken it and then sort of gave back most of it, clapped Austria, could have taken it all, gave back most of it, and weren't really doing anything in Africa. And that's because he argued all of the right things about why colonialism is a bad idea. It's not very respectful. It doesn't really work. Economically, you end up spending more than you get. It's not good for growing free trade. It instead sort of gets these trade blocks that aren't really good for competition. And it's unpopular. And it's unpopular. And they couldn't sustain it because they didn't have a big navy. Anyway, he then changes his mind, which is part of, I think, where he starts to fall apart a little bit. And in part to support new kind of white elephant projects, he proposes a beer tax of like something ridiculous, like 2%. Well, and for the first time, there are cartoons coming out in the German press that say, I don't know about this old man who wants to tax beer. Maybe he's been around for too long. And Kaiser Wilhelm II is like, well, you see now, so people are saying they don't want these things. And so, you know, maybe it must go away. And of course, what results from that is an imperialist project, which increases German taxes by some orders of magnitude before leading into one of the grand defeats, both in the First and Second World Wars.
One of the key points about World War I is that Germany's behavior in the lead up to the war, a lot of it flies in the face of Otto von Bismarck's goals in foreign policy. He had really tried to make sure that Germany didn't get dragged into any wars at two fronts and that there was a kind of balance of power in Europe, and that all basically just kind of gets tossed out the window.
And that it wouldn't try to pursue like either land grab policies or the kinds of silly race-based policies that so excited the situation in the Balkans. Remember the Balkans down in the south were occupied in part by the Austro-Hungarian Empire and part by the Ottoman Empire, both of which were sort of multiracial entities that were founded on other kinds of values. In the Ottoman case, much more on religion, and in the Austro-Hungarian one, much more on some version of an enlightened kind of pluralistic
kind of
set of values.
But yeah, you know, the family.
The only bloodline that matters is the Habsburgs.
It's the Habsburgs, yes. And the state is full of weird compromises between various local elites and the...
Yeah, and it's very cosmopolitan. Vienna is the birthplace of psychology and all kinds of breakthroughs in literature, precisely because, you know, modernist literature. The guy in Trieste that Ulysses was based on, that James Joyce's work was based on, because it was so multicultural, because you had a melting pot. And then that collapses because in the Balkans, they're like, no, Slavs, no, we must be Slavs. No, we must be Teutons. No, we must be Aryans. No, we must be Larazza Italians, so on and so forth. That's exactly what Bismarck thought is going to screw everything up.
And it did. And Kaiser Wilhelm, of course, is very keen on this German stuff, on race nationalist stuff. He talks a lot about the white race and the yellow peril and all that sort of thing. So one of his next big snafus, I don't know, I'm sure anyone here who listens to us who's... read about the history of the First World War, knows that in the First World War, the Allies often referred to the Germans as Huns. And you might think, oh, well, it's just sort of a term of abuse that kind of, you know, just because the Germans are barbarians or whatever, and that was the view of the Allies. But actually, it comes from a speech given by Kaiser Wilhelm. So Kaiser Wilhelm was seeing off some German troops who were about to go to Namibia, and these troops would, as it turns out, go out to Namibia and do some very terrible things to the Herero and Nama people in Namibia, which some people have called a genocide. And Kaiser Wilhelm gives a speech where
probably
he says,
rightly.
Where he says to these troops before they go off, you must be like the Huns and basically destroy everything in your way. You must have no pity and things like that. So he gives this really fiery speech. And his staff, Kaiser Wilhelm's staff, realizes instantly this is a PR disaster. He just told a bunch of soldiers that they must behave like Huns, right? When they're supposed to be going off to do some sort of, you know, I mean, the way it's a colonialism.
Civilizing mission.
Yeah, civilizing mission of the peoples of Namibia, right? It's even worse when you know that they went off and then, you know, genocided the local population. But this is, you know, even if they hadn't done that, this is pretty bad. So they immediately round up every reporter and have them basically suppress the story, because that's how Germany worked back then. However, there was a reporter who was sitting on a roof nearby because he couldn't get like into the crowd and he wanted to basically be above things so he could see what was going on. And he escapes the notice of the authorities and he goes off and publishes this. So it goes all around Europe.
So that's what I love about that story is that my mother's one bit of concrete advice that she gives me every time I go out into the field to do some journalism is she says, the really smart journalists don't get lost in the crowd. She was very angry with me when these people threw rocks at my car and said they wanted to kill me. She said, you mustn't do that. You must go and sit on the roof like a proper journalist and take photos from above where no one can see you and listen to what's happening from far away. And this is the perfect example that you can actually tell a story that
otherwise you wouldn't be able to tell.
Impresses exactly. History in this profound way that all Germans come to be known as Huns because a smart chap sat on a roof.
Exactly. So, you know.
Dude, and then tell us about, because I've got this Russian thing. Please tell us about, like, so the Russians had this complicated situation where they were the largest empire on Earth, sort of by landmass, and had covered, you know, gone all the way to the East Coast, and it was a bit of a collapse of China, had taken some of Manchuria and gotten a lease on some of the ports. And so the Russians were trying to figure out, just the background of this is that the Russian diplomatic corps was trying to figure out, what should our emphasis be? Should we be trying to expand our territory further to the east? Should we be trying to kind of develop infrastructure in those parts of Russia that are already Russia? Or should we be trying to attack the West, make friends with the West?
Right. So there was, you know, there was a kind of, racial nationalist Slav project to go into the Balkans and expand Russian influence there and, you know, fight the Ottomans and take Istanbul / Constantinople or Tsargrad, as the Russians call it, and that should be the focus of Russian politics. And then there was also this thought that maybe they should go east and, as Gabriel said, they should kind of build up their eastern frontiers in Siberia and into China and that kind of thing. And they were building a Trans-Siberian Railroad, which is this massive, long piece of infrastructure all the way through Siberia to help link their big port in the east, Vladivostok, with the rest of the country. Now, this, of course, worries a lot of the countries in Asia, particularly China, but China's kind of weak and is getting hit by basically everyone, so they can't do much about it. But newly industrialized Japan is a bit freaked out by this. Now, they don't think they can take the Russians on, but they think to themselves, well, you know, we need to see if we can kind of nudge them into respecting our dominance of Korea. And in return, we'll just kind of leave them alone to do what they want with China. Because they're very worried that the Russians are basically going to take over Korea and then they're going to be in Japan next. And the Japanese they're only recently coming up in the world. They've only recently modernized. They don't have a lot of self-confidence yet. And they only a few decades earlier had some very bad experiences with the West where they were completely outmatched. So they are very nervous about taking on a big power. They're also very fearful. And when countries are fearful, they often get a bit warish. So there's this growing crisis now between Russia and Japan over control of the East. And Tsar Nicholas II, who's of course the Tsar of Russia, he's not really keen on fighting a war out there. You know, he thinks it's a bit, risky. They don't have that many soldiers out there. The railroad isn't finished. So they can't really get people out there. He kind of would, you know, prefer peace. I mean, Nicholas was he was probably a terrible leader from everything I've read about him, but he wasn't. I don't think he was some sort of homicidal maniac, unlike certain Kaisers. And so he's writing, because back then all the monarchs of Europe used to write letters to each other, right? All the time.
And their cousins.
Because they were all related, yeah. You know, they were all grandchildren of Queen Victoria, interestingly. So he writes this letter to Kaiser Wilhelm, and Kaiser Wilhelm says, No, you can't have peace with the Japanese. You can't trust them. The devious Asian is like is a threat to all of Christian civilization. And what they're going to do is go into Manchuria, and they're going to arm thousands and thousands of Chinese people with rifles, and they're going to invade Russia. And you can't possibly have it. You need to show them that, put them in their place, and defend the white race. He writes these letters, and at some point, Nicholas writes back to him and says, I'd rather have peace with the Japanese. And Kaiser Wilhelm replies, what an innocent angel that you showed no understanding of the mind of the Oriental.
Right. And there's another racist crap. Yeah.
Yeah. There's another reason, of course, that Kaiser Wilhelm is doing this, which is that he desperately wants the Russians to go off and focus their attention to the Far East so that they don't mess about in Europe and interfere with Germany or Austria, which is kind of what Kaiser Wilhelm cares about.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever, that's how that's some foreign policy there, but he uses some explicitly racial stuff to do it. And he keeps making speeches about the so-called yellow peril, which is this fear of some Asian nation becoming powerful and dominant. This contributes, although of course it's not the only thing, to Russia and Japan going to war. And rather humiliatingly, Russia loses to newly industrialized Japan. And they don't just lose.
The white race. It turns out being white's not that great.
Yeah, it's not
doesn't stop not a bullets. Foolproof.
Yeah, it's not foolproof. And there's a great story of the Russian fleet trying to get to Japan from the west, so from the Baltic, and that's a great story. Perhaps we can tell it another time. But anyway, so that's
I'll just tell it. The long and the short of it is that the one Russian ship kind of gets separated from the rest, and then finally meets up with its friends like a month or two later or whatever it is, and they're like, "Oh, how are you doing?" And they're like, "Oh no, we had a terrible battle with the Japanese fleet, but we fired 300 shells and we fought very bravely." And they say, "Oh, well done, you guys are so amazing." And then they figure out that it was like a French merchant fleet. It's just like a bunch of fishing ships.
And some Swedish ships.
And some Swedish ships. And they missed. They didn't even.
And it gets worse, because this was also the second incident the Russians had had on that journey, where they had got into a fight. While on their way to Japan, they passed by Great Britain, and in the area called the Dogger Bank, they thought that they were being attacked by a fleet of Japanese torpedo boats. Now, how Japanese torpedo boats would be in the middle of the North Sea on the other side of Europe. Anyway, they panicked and started firing at some British fishing ships, thinking that these were Japanese torpedo boats. They first hit one of their own ships. So technically speaking, in the fight between the fishing boats and the Russian Navy, the fishing boats drew first blood. But they ended up killing some British sailors, and Britain almost went to war with Russia over this, because they were already allied to Japan. So it was
So the only people who were really surprised were those who thought that like being white makes you smart. Basically, but everyone else is just an unadulterated cock-up.
And, of course, all of this yellow peril stuff that Kaiser Wilhelm had helped to popularize across Europe meant that when the Russian soldiers entered, because a lot of the fighting took place in China, they believed that because the Chinese were Asians, that they were automatically on the side of the Japanese, and so treated them really badly as well, which was not really true, because the Chinese don't really like the Japanese. And so it was a big mess. So Kaiser Wilhelm, I think we can conclusively say, was a real bad hombre. Also, of course, his militant racial nationalism and his strutting about and his belief in German superiority and all of that sort of thing contributes to this beginning of the First World War, which, as we all know, was a complete catastrophe. But here's
for me the itself final... led to the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the Second World War.
Exactly. So Kaiser Wilhelm, like, I think he's the second ever German emperor. He was also the worst German emperor, pretty conclusively. But here's all you need to know about the character of Kaiser Wilhelm. Kaiser Wilhelm, after World War I, is forced into exile in the Netherlands because the German Empire collapses and it becomes the Weimar Republic, right? However, Hitler rises to power, as we all know, and he begins World War II, and he starts invading neighboring countries, and he invades the Netherlands. And as German troops sweep across the Netherlands, Kaiser Wilhelm, who's sitting in exile there, goes, well, isn't this great? Look, Germany's back on the rise again. So he writes a letter to Hitler and he says, ah, excellent job. Thank you very much for restoring Germany to her former glory. Are you going to reappoint me Kaiser right now? Because I'd rather like that. Hitler says, no. So, delusional, racist, unpleasant moron.
Yeah, who also I think really did contribute to just the worst calamities. So, okay, so bad hombre, no, one of the worst dudes.
Yeah.
And that revision, I think the reason that this requires a bit of a revision is that there was an idea, and this is an important idea for the Brits and many of the allies, that emerged out of World War I and that sort of locked in the Treaty of Versailles, was that people kind of bought into this race nationalist idea, both on the outside and on the inside. They started to think of the German as a kind of person defined by a bloodline who is inherently more barbaric and militant, aggressive.
And kills Belgians whenever he can.
And rapacious and Belgium killing and so on. Right. And it's worth noting that idea doesn't come from nowhere and it doesn't come from bloodlines. It doesn't come from genetically inherited characteristics. What it really does come from is the fount of the esteem market in that part of the world, which was the Kaiser, the person who bestows honors and disgrace upon people according to his own belief system. But because he's so well regarded, sets a trend. I think that if you look from the late 19th century into the beginnings of the 20th century, you'll struggle to find someone as important and influential pushing as much race-based realpolitik as Kaiser Wilhelm II. I'm not saying that he's alone. Generally, this idea was on the rise. And for sure, there are important academics in Germany, in the UK, in France, in Russia who are pushing this kind of thing. There are important editors of newspapers which have a great taste-making role. But it's hard to find a king
right,
who is as belligerent and as race-based as old Kaiser Wilhelm II. There's one little sweet anecdote, which is that Ludwig II was the emperor of Bavaria. So Germany, although it is unified, preserved, Bavaria. Much like South Africa.
King of Bavaria, not emperor of Bavaria.
King of Bavaria, Kaiser of Bavaria, whatever you want to call him. Germany, much like South Africa, kept its kings. You know, lots of different little kings. And so Ludwig was one of the kings, and he built this wonderful castle that I visited, that the Walt Disney, it's called like the Fantasia Castle or something.
Yes. I'm sure people have seen pictures of it before because it's absolutely beautiful.
It is so gorgeous. It looks like it comes from before time, but really it was made in the 1860s.
It's literally what the fairy tale kind of castle is based off of, is that castle.
Yeah. The Disney castle is based off that castle. And the interesting thing about Ludwig is that Ludwig is gay and tries to get married, and it just doesn't work out. Him and the lady are really open about the fact in their letters that they don't really love each other. They really love Wagner, and so they call each other by the names of characters from Wagnerian opera, and sort of really it's a kind of bloodless romance grounded in a shared admiration of the opera. It was very sweet, but it doesn't work. And then he ends up shagging the master of the horse, which is the sort of head stable boy or whatever you call it. But I think the master of the horse is a pretty sexy title.
It's an important honorific in European court cultures.
Yeah. So what matters about this is because the prevailing norms of the time hold homosexuality, hold open homosexuality in complete disdain. It had to be kept a complete secret, although it was a bit of a sort of well-known secret within the family.
That's one of and those open secret type things, yeah.
Yeah, not that open, but like just within the family, yeah.
Right.
And one of the I read an account when I was in university, sort of to argue that Kaiser Wilhelm II was aware of Ludwig II's what's Oscar Wilde's term? Bumbristness. I don't know. Oscar Wilde had a funny term for this kind of secret liaison. Anyway, and then he was a bit embarrassed, and then he felt like it was all the more important to show that we are real men by being real bloody sort of Aryans.
Oh,
so that even if there is a thing like, so you can add a kind of terrible homophobic slant to everything else that's already been said. He's just one of the worst people. And Karl Peters was the sort of Rhodes of the Germans who defied the Foreign Office's orders to break into Uganda and use machine guns to plow down human beings as if they were sort of millicops in the field and expand the German Empire. And the Foreign Office was very upset by this and said, we're not going to respect these treaties because we explicitly ordered you to stay within your bounds and not go ahead and do this kind of thing. And Kaiser Wilhelm II sort of vetoes that as one of his first moves as a young ranking sort of officer waiting to take the risk. So, and Karl Peters, just by the way, of Lord Goldie, who's the worst of the Brits and really screwed up Nigeria, Cecil John Rhodes, and the French guy, not Brazza, the guy comes afterwards. Anyway, of the major powers, they all had these terrible colonialists who, like, once they're on the ground, do this thing that Joseph Conrad so famously portrayed of kind of really going against what the Home Office is ordering and becoming local sort of chiefs.
People and stuff, yeah.
Exploiting people with their superior arms. You had a little bit of this coming from all of the major powers, but Karl Peters was by far the most rapacious. I mean, the only thing worse than that is the genocide of the Herero. And Kaiser Wilhelm was on side with all of that. So he's a bad guy. Okay, so let's turn to Jan Smuts, because I think he's more complicated. I think there's a more complicated appraisal to be made. So here's my spiel. And this is based on reading Richard Stain's book, which we've mentioned a few times, Seven Votes, How World War II Changed South Africa Forever, as well as some essays by Herman Gilliomeer, who was a former president of the Institute of Race Relations and one of this country's great historians. I've been reading some of his essays from a collection, but particularly reading the essays around the build-up of apartheid.
So the sort of 1940s, 1930s era.
Yeah. So the interesting – Herman Gilliomeer makes this interesting argument that apartheid is not nearly the sort of popular movement that people make it out to be, in the sense that – not in the sense that the Nats didn't sort of win a popular vote, but both he and Richard Stain point out to the fact that the United Party being led by Smuts might have done better, might have actually held onto power against the Nationalist Party if the constituency lines had been perhaps more fairly drawn or perhaps just otherwise drawn. Right. But more in what I would simply translate, but I think their language very much supports this, more in the esteem economy sense of people not having their minds made up about a racially segregated South Africa, and certainly not about having a kind of one oppressor race, but being sort of led in that direction by the combination of prestige being distributed to those who push the idea, as well as the opponents being ostracized. Black people like J.B. Marx, what's his name, M.Z. Nkele, some of the members even of the ANC youth wing, certainly A.B. Kuma, who's the head of the ANC, or Zuma, depending on the convention of pronunciation. You know, both black leaders and white leaders were quite pragmatic and sort of wanted to get along and weren't happy about the Land Act, weren't happy about voting rights, but would have been sympathetic to a franchised vote so that, you know, I don't know, property owners or people
would have existed in the Cape.
Yeah.
Possibly expanding it.
Which is how democracies have usually grown in a stable, non-violent and non-oppressive way. It's not that everyone suddenly gets the vote. It's that you roll it out slowly but surely, and every sort of generation, more and more people get it until you get to the point where everyone has it. Now, I think some absolutists about democracy would say that that's not good enough and it's in fact very bad. But I think most people would agree that that would be better than going through apartheid first before getting to universal franchise. So, yeah. So one of the thoughts is that this is an idea on the table, that real leaders are ready for this idea, but that it's not being implemented. In fact, the opposite. So Jan Smuts is in this funny position where early in his career, when he first becomes prime minister straight after Louis Botha, he does push a more frankly non-racial line. And then loses an election. And there's two kinds of big race debates. The one is thinking of Afrikaners, white Afrikaners as a race, or Afrikaners more broadly as a race. And Herman Gilliamier does a lot of research to show that Afrikaner 100 years ago was used to mean, you know, not English. That Afrikaners were mostly white and colored. And sometimes Afrikaner was used by Smuts, for example, in an inclusive sense. He said, sometimes I use it inclusively to mean everyone who lives in Africa and wants Africa to succeed. But sometimes I use it exclusively, and then I'm just not talking about the English. So there was this Afrikaner race, and there was the English race, and there was a bit of beef there from the scorched earth and the 7 in 10 women and children being killed in the concentration camps and all of that. And so you had to make peace between those two, and then you also had to make peace between black and white, or white and all the other colors. And Jan Smuts was pushing a non-racialist line on both fronts and then loses the election, and the Nationalist Party, or a form of the Nationalist Party, comes into power, and Herzog becomes a sort of grand leader, and Smuts kind of then aligns with Herzog and becomes his deputy. But he seems to have learned the wrong lesson from his slip in power. The right lesson would have been, if you're going to push this idea, you're going to get a bit of a backlash, and then you need to keep with it and push it harder, and then you'll make it through. The lesson he learned was not that. Instead, it was, look, if you go against kind of what the fashionable people are saying right now, then you're going to lose your power, and I'm better than the alternative. So the most important thing is that I stay in power. And right. If you track Jan Smuts's legacy from 1939, when he becomes prime minister for the second time, after Herzog resigns in frustration with parliament's vote to go to war, a vote won by 7 votes, the title of Saint's book, Smuts becomes ever more preoccupied with retaining power and ever less preoccupied with any kind of sort of policy consistency or sense of principle. In fact, he says of his deputy, Jan Hofmeyr, who's even more non-racialist. I mean, right. Jan Hofmeyr is talking about rolling out the vote to black people and sort of rolling back laws about discriminating.
Yeah, he was the great South African liberal hope, basically.
Yeah. And Jan Smuts says, you know, the problem with this guy, he's very young and he still believes in principles. And it's, you know. I'm paraphrasing here, but he really does say the problem is he still believes in principles and he hasn't yet figured out that that's not how it works. So the sort of interesting historical note is that the major scandal at the time was this very small legislative amendment, small in the sense, not morally, but geographically, that in Durban, Cato Manor and around there, actually, a sort of place that's remained historically very interesting, there was clash both between black and Indian. This is the Cato Manor story, where a lot of Indian people are killed by black people, and it sort of increases racial tensions. But there's also a clash between white suburbanites and Indian suburbanites. So there's parts of Durban where Indians are sort of running businesses and owning homes, and it's super Indian. And then there's parts that are kind of mixed. And white people are starting to get worried about Indian people moving in. By the way, not all of them. It's not like a big popular groundswell, but there are these elite sort of cheerleaders that are saying, no, you can't let this happen. So we've got to draft legislation to designate white only areas and keep the Indians out. Right. So this is literally suburban level politics, but it's not exactly non-racial, and it's not exactly moving in a non-racial direction. It's moving the other way. And so it's a test case for what Jan Smuts is going to do. Okay, you've inherited this system from Louis Botha and then now from Herzog of lots of racial divisions. Which way are you pushing? Are you going to push to reinstate colored people's right to vote everywhere, or are you going to push for colored people to be taken off the roll in the Western Cape? Are you going to be pushing for more people? Now World War II has happened. Lots of people had to go to war. And so lots of people from the countryside have moved to the cities to fill these jobs. And now there's lots of black people getting new, nice jobs. Are you going to allow this and grow it, or are you going to push back against it? This is the major national political question. And right. Smuts very much is like, we must push against it. Now, you can't push against it all the way. He says to the Institute of Race Relations, he makes a speech in the around World War II. He says it would be like trying to sweep away the sea. You can't send all the black people home. But at the same time, you can't really respect black people, even though I'm writing this sort of universal rights of declaration for the United Nations formation, and I'm very fancy out there for saying how important it is to respect people. You mustn't really respect people.
Even while he's been heavily involved in the Second World War against, you know, Nazi tyranny in Europe and racial tyranny in Europe,
yeah,
sort of kind of misses the point somehow that this is kind of the same thing as what's going on at home.
And so the grand argument, and Smuts makes this argument in his, in public and to the Institute of Race Relations and in his private letters. The argument for Smuts is that if you don't vote for me, you're going to get something much worse. I am a compassionate and reasonable racist. I'm happy to work with black people. I'm happy to kind of have an arm's length kind of respect. And the other guys are much, 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 much worse racists. So right. Really what you need is a moderate kind of cuddly, internationally respected, well-meaning, well-intentioned, semi-racialist rather than a full-blooded racist.
I think one of Smuts's party slogans for a time was white leadership with justice.
Yes. So he was very much for the – he was like, we must be in charge, but we must be good custodians. We must really take care of everyone else in a very nice way. Right. And we can so do that. But if you give the other guys the chance –
racism.
Yes. If you give the other guys the chance, then it's not going to be good because the leader just doesn't have as good a character. So it really just comes down to the differences. I've got – you know, I'm a better guy than they are. I'll do this better than they will. So you must let me be the grandfather of the nation. Let it happen at my beck and call. And in case you think that I'm exaggerating this, after the election, I got a quote from our colleague Michael Morris, who's written a wonderful history of 150 years of the sort of independent media house. Yes. And so pulled this quote that Smuts had said from newspaper archives from 48, 49, just after Smuts loses the election. Some 4 months after losing to the National Party, Smuts himself revealed the disabling indistinctiveness of the United Party when sparring with his nemesis, D.F. Malan, in a debate. He said, now this is Smuts saying, we have always stood and we stand for social and residential separation in this country and for the avoidance of all racial mixture. When Malan interjected, is that your apartheid? Smuts responded, with the telling concession that, quote, there is a great deal about apartheid that is common to all parties, end quote, offering as the apparently sole defining feature of the United Party opposition that, quote, we see no reason to change the political rights, small as they are, of the native people and the colored people of this country. The small position they have in the parliament of this country, let them keep. Let them have their share here too. So this is the difference between a slightly not as bad racist and a full-blooded racist.
Right. So that's not exactly a full-throated defense of the principles of all human beings being equal and non-racial equality.
By their deeds, so ye shall judge them. By their fruits, so ye shall weigh them up. The fruits indeed of Jan Smuts' apartheid light policy was to eliminate any possibility of real opposition, of a real alternative. The United Party had half of the electorate in the bag. It had it for all the same reasons that parties have this thing. Brand, loyalty, its ability to do some very good things for some of the people that were voting for it over the last few decades. The fact that the esteem market just works like this, it gets together and people then like it. It is the relatively moderate party. So as long as Smuts was pushing apartheid light, there was no room for a real centrist party to emerge, because where's it going to come from? And anyone who tries to split, they'll just say, no, you're splitting the moderate opposition, or you're splitting the moderate government, and that's just going to put more power into the hands of the radical race-based socialists. This all sounds to me astonishingly similar to the South Africa we sit in today. The difference between Cyril Ramaphosa and Nkosi Dlamini Zuma is not in kind. It is in degree. The difference between Cyril Ramaphosa and Julius Malema is not in kind. It is in degree. This is not my view that I'm pulling out of the air. This is the view that Ramaphosa himself espouses. He says, look, the difference between me and these guys is I'm a little bit nicer. I'm a little bit more willing to say, have a small share. You don't, not everyone has to have class suicide or be driven into the sea. We don't have to contemplate the slaughtering of all whites. Ramaphosa doesn't go saying, maybe we're going to kill all white people. He's much, much nicer than Julius Malema. But we have a choice. We can go in one of two directions. We can go for more non-racialism or more racialism. And Ramaphosa says, BEE, what did he just say this morning? The headline is, Ramaphosa says the economy must be bigger and blacker. Last year, he said the economy is terribly racist. When we were in the midst of the worst economic crisis since World War II, he says, no, don't worry. The problem is that it's racist, and this calamity is actually part of the solution to that problem.
Yes.
He is different in kind, not in degree. And I think that if you look at South Africa between 1910 and 1948, you find a country that is properly unjust, much worse than the injustices of the last 30 years. Let's not compare them in degree, but in kind, there is a similarity. BEE is a kind of race-based law. The overt policy of trying to say, of serving our people as a sworn president of the country, where our people does not include all South Africans, but only include South Africans on the basis of the race. This is a kind of color-based policy. So everyone can vote, and that's very good. And everyone legally is allowed to own property everywhere. And we all promise protection under the law that is equal. Now, that is very, very different to South Africa in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. But we don't have actual equality before the law. And that's another similarity. And we don't have a government that overtly represents all people. And that's another very sad similarity. So we are like a diluted version of that problem. Now, what came after that problem was worse. And the most bizarre and ironic thing, and the thing to hold on to, is that the Afrikaner Nationalist Party project had three planks. The one plank was to redefine Afrikaner so that it meant something racial. Now we can see a similar program today where instead of where the African National Party's program is to redefine Zulu and Xhosa and Kasi and so on, all these actual cultures, to redefine them as subsidiaries of the grand black culture. So there's a cultural project here. We want to create an esteem economy where everyone is buying into the same code of conduct on the basis of the color of their skin. This is the sort of soft side of it. The hard side of it is the Afrikaner Nationalist Project was race-based. It was a race nationalist project. The idea was to say this country is specifically here to serve one particular race, and others can stay or go according to how well they serve the interests of the one particular race. We see the same thing happening here. And it's socialist in the sense that we need more government intervention. We need the government to own more stuff, to interfere more in jobs, appointments, and so on and so forth, so that we can have Afrikaner economic empowerment. And I'm not the first person to notice that this is Afrikaner economic empowerment was the basic policy of D.F. Malan. This is noticed by very sweet people in the Mail and Guardian over the last decade and a half, who've said, look, they had Afrikaner economic empowerment. Now we must have black economic empowerment. So I'm not even the one drawing this analogy. This analogy has been drawn by proponents of black economic empowerment. They say AEE worked. After A comes B. Now we need BEE. The amazing thing about this third side, which is really the side where the rubber hits the road, because it's where equality before the law gets eroded, and it's where everything else becomes about money and power. And so it's hard to actually talk on the grounds of reason, is that the argument for Afrikaner economic empowerment had never been weaker than in 1948. In 1905, the Afrikaners had very real grievances. People had just been slaughtered in big numbers. Uh-huh. There'd just been a very nasty war.
Wrecked. Yeah. And
also, education, British civil service was entirely British. The education system meant that, like, Brits could read, very few Afrikaners could read. This all changes. Very few Afrikaners are wealthy, capitalist, merchants, manufacturers, anything like that. By 1948, Afrikaners are the majority of the civil service and have attained the most important positions in the sort of heights of the civil service, including this guy whose name I can't remember right now, but the guy who's started Eskom and Iskor and all of these things. He was close ally of Jan Smuts. He was almost like the Patrice Motsepe of the day. He was like the billionaire Afrikaner who, through private initiative and excellence, had established these Afrikaans institutions that were working really well for everyone. The middle class was growing in the professions, doctors, lawyers, all of this kind of thing. Suddenly there was lots and lots of Afrikaans doctors and lawyers. The argument for AEE was at its weakest exactly when it became its most potent. Yeah. And the temptation for South Africans today is to think, just like Jan Smuts thought between 1945 and 1948, and all of his friends thought, the temptation was to think, no, but we can't lose to this project. Jan Smuts thinks DF Malan can't win because, look, life is so much nicer for Afrikaans people now than ever before. And he's just, his whole argument is premised on the thought that life was very terrible a long time ago for Afrikaners, and everyone didn't like Afrikaners. And the Brits did all say that Afrikaners were baboons and such like. But it's not grounded in reality, and things have been getting better. And so it's going to be fine. And that's why he thinks he doesn't have to push against the Indian exclusion in Durban. That's why I think we'll just appease a little bit. If we can just give them one more crumb, then they're going to get fed up and they're going to be so happy because everything's going so well that they're going to stop this nonsense. But it's the opposite. The desperate argument for race-based socialism gains its greatest potency, at least in the South African context, exactly when it is the least meritorious, when it's the most detached from reality, because the last thing that you have is force and the mythological power of real esteem manipulation. So you really have to get it going. And this is the worry with South Africa, that Jan Smuts, that Cyril Ramaphosa, much like Jan Smuts, is a nice guy, is a much nicer guy than any of the immediate alternatives.
Zuma or any of them.
Very nice guy. And he really does think that white people should have some small part to play. And isn't it sweet that he says so? And you can get along with him very nicely. And everything will be okay if you just give another two crumbs. Just expropriation of compensation, but not everywhere. Just take two farms. If they can just have two suburbs of Durban or whatever, two suburbs, right.
You can see a really good example of where this ends up by looking at how the expropriation bill debate has gone in Parliament. The debate at the moment is not between those who say it's a terrible idea and those who say it's a great idea. The debate is currently whether the land should all be nationalized or just the state should keep all of the power to be nationalized, right? This seems to be the kind of division at the moment, right?
Right.
To be fair,
it's like, should all the land be nationalized or some of the land? And should the state be taking custodianship or should it be giving title deeds? So Ramaphosa is coming out like a good guy because he's like, no, we must expropriate all that compensation, but we can give title deeds. Title deeds are very nice. So he seems very reasonable by comparison to the other side. No, we agree that we have to take away people's stuff. We're going to grow by acid, by burning.
It's kind of like we've agreed that someone's going to get stabbed. We're just deciding with how deep the knife here, I think, on this one.
Yeah. And people, I think, are very easily bamboozled by this proposition. They were bamboozled. Jan Smuts won the khaki election. You know, it's not like he didn't, much like Ramaphosa, you know, he had a slightly discredited government. It had its problems, but he managed to hold it together by being the sort of lesser of two evils.
But also there's another problem which I'd just like to draw to here, which is that Jan Smuts made far too much of it about himself in that sense, right? There was loyalty to people. A lot of people called themselves Smuts men, right? I used to know some guys who were Smuts men. And then, of course, he dies. And then, you know, who is there to stand in the United Party against the nationalists?
Yeah. Well, first he loses and then he dies. And then it's
then we have to
wait until Hazen Sussman comes, the cricket in the thorn tree.
Exactly. And then the United Party has to split in what is a traumatic thing. And the new Progressive Party, the Liberals, have to spend all of their time fighting with the United Party just to build a political coalition to actually provide some real opposition.
A real alternative to apartheid, yeah.
Cyril, if Cyril is all that stands between us and, you know, the abyss, what happens if there's no Cyril?
Then we are already falling. Then we are already off the edge of the cliff. If it is true that Cyril is the only thing stopping us, then we are in big trouble. Then it's already happened. Here's why this point matters. Here's what's useful about history. When I was at school, some of my friends who were also poor at this fancy rich school and who were black. I asked them, why don't you like the capitalist thing? Because I was like a fiscal conservative because I thought Trevor Manuel had it right. And I'd say, why don't you like this thing? And they'd say, because the capitalists always come along and they promise happiness today. They say it's all going to be fine tomorrow. Or everything, if you just let us do our way, it's going to be fine tomorrow. And we just know that's not true. We can feel it's not true. So we don't trust people who promise happiness tomorrow. Because we know it's not going to work. At least the struggle guys say that it's going to be happiness down the line. We must keep suffering with this thing, but it will get there in some years. It's a long project, this thing. And George Orwell was very much of that view. In his review of Mein Kampf in 1941, he says, you know, the capitalists offer happiness now. The socialists offer happiness tomorrow. The interesting thing about the fascists is that they promise suffering. And so he says you must also recognize that promising suffering can be very compelling. But I do think it's a terrible mistake to promise happiness tomorrow. It's not going – this country's – you must have a long view. If these things are going to improve, we're going to keep getting worse economically, you know, relative to global emerging markets. We're not going to get to 6% GDP growth next year or the year thereafter or the year thereafter. And even the best policies aren't going to get us there. It's going to take at least 5 years to get us there. And once you get there, it's still going to take another 5 years before you eat away into unemployment till it gets to 25%. And 25% unemployment is like worse than the worst country in Europe. So these things take time.
In the very short term, things would probably actually get a little bit worse because there would be a lot of instability and pushback by special interest groups.
Yeah. Toying by the unions, all kinds of things.
Exactly.
If you really want to see, if you don't want to see this nonsense new dawn, oh my goodness. If you're looking for hope tomorrow, then all that's happened is you've made the kind of mistake that 13-year-old boys at St. Stithians who had just crawled out of the townships could see through, that you mustn't think that someone is going to go and make this country happy tomorrow. If you're looking for real happiness in the future, you must look in the longer term. And then history can be a nice guide. What does it mean 10 years? What does it mean 20 years? Well, history gives you that sense. And if you start looking in a 10 or 20-year time horizon, and my analogy between Ramaphosa and Smuts holds, then you must seriously consider the possibility that this is the good times. That in the 2040s, people are going to look back on the 2010s and the 2020s as the good times. That once Ramaphosa's dead, they're going to be Ramaphosiacs for the next 100 years who say, he was so nice. Look how well everything was going until he ran out of power and we had to put Dlamini Zuma in charge or Malema in charge or whomever it was. And the alternative is that, you know, people figure out that Ramaphosa's sort of the last thing standing between us and oblivion. And so change the constitution. Once you've changed the Bill of Rights, it's not such a big thing to exchange the term limits.
And then it's
Ethiopia. Like McGarvey, yes.
Literally not able to walk properly, but still in the chair as the leader.
So there's another nightmare possibility that comes into light only if you see the longer term. And if you want to see the hope in the longer term, it's not that people trust in a character. There is no character. There's no Smuts. Smuts was, for sure, the best politician in the country until Nelson Mandela or F.W. de Klerk. But he was not nearly enough. You can't trust characters to save you. It has to be an idea. It has to be a set of principles, a set of real values that can coordinate real action. And that will take years. It is going to take years for people to realize, not just privately, that racism is not the problem. 80% of South Africans already know that. Our survey showed. It's going to take years just to go from people privately knowing it to making it a thing that's taken for granted in the public debate, where someone says, no, it's racist. You get laughed off. Oh, we need the economy to be blacker. Oh, they get laughed off. It's going to take years for that to become a joke. It's going to take years for the alternative, the non-racialist alternative, to become a real engaging idea. And yeah, our work, I suppose my work is premised on the thought that it is going to take years, and that if I look on the broader time horizon, the alternative really is that as after Smuts came apartheid, so too after Ramaphosa, we really see what black socialism, race-based socialism, means at scale. The argument for BEE has never been weaker, and yet the pundits have never pushed harder, and they are changing the laws in myriad ways. Guns taken out of people's hands. Post office taking all. We're going mad. The policy makers in this country, the lawmakers in this country, are going mad in exactly the way that they were going mad after World War II. Just when it least made sense, they pushed hardest.
What's that?
And the problem is, South Africans didn't stand up to it then. Maybe they won't stand up to it now. They knew better, but they kept quiet.
Who was it? I think it was Oscar Wilde or someone who said that history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. This sounds an awful lot like a rhyme, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, we must call it to a close there, because we are, I think, pretty much over time. So recommendations. As ever, I'm going to ask you first. Do you have anything?
Okay, I do. I've been kept sane by Roland Garros, otherwise known as the French Open, which is kind of funny. But you can tell that someone's an Anglophile when they call it Wimbledon and the French Open. When they don't say the UK Open and the French Open and the Australian Open. No, Wimbledon. Wimbledon is a special thing. So
very good.
I like Roland Garros. I've really been – last night there was a great game between Roger Federer and a young German called Kupfler. And Federer is like 40 years old and he really shouldn't be playing tennis, but he's so good at it. It's so elegant. It's nice to watch. And Kupfler got a little bit frustrated at one point, so he walks to Federer's side of the net because they play on clay. So you can see exactly where the ball landed. So the umpire says it is out. He says, no, it wasn't out. Then the umpire runs down and looks. He says, no, I can see it was out. So then Kupfler runs over to see it as well and so angry that he spits into the clay. And and this is like, you know, I love rugby. I love watching like, you know, men like 120 kgs, two fridges flying into each other at high velocity, sort of limbs. You know, it's like very visceral kind of satisfying thing to see this approximation of war. Somehow this French kind of tennis thing, you see a man sort of spit onto a puff of dust and it feels even more violent, feels even more scandalous. And I think that gives a sense of tennis. I love it. It's like boxing. It's the most sophisticated form of boxing. They stand at the baseline and they punch as hard as they can and you need technique and it's extremely tiring. And yet there's this great proximity so you can see it all play out over time and space, elegance and a bit of ballet and a lot of kind of chess kind of thinking. It's a great relief to me. And I recommend, yeah, I don't know. Even if you don't like tennis, I picked up tennis like 2 years ago. Hey? It's not something that I was brought up into. And I think that's a quality thing about it too. It's very accessible. Very nice.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to recommend, now this is late because the show has been out forever and probably everyone has watched it who's going to watch it. But I've recently started watching It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is kind of unique in sitcom TV show type things, in that rather than trying to make you like its characters, it kind of tries to make you hate its characters because all of them are really despicable and disgusting. Now, I will say that this show is not for everyone. It's filled with lots of dark jokes and gross subject matter, but it is quite hilarious, I found. I think it's some good stuff. And it often does plays fun little games with like hot button topics, whether it be everything from abortion to the Israel-Palestine conflict to welfare. It's got like, I think the first season, basically every episode is about some other new, extremely heated hot button topic, which is quite funny. But yeah, so check that out. I don't know where actually it's easy to watch these days, but anyway. And I think that is all the time we have for today. So we hope you enjoyed our ramblings about great historical things. And we will see you hopefully next week, assuming that Gabriel doesn't try to change the soul and minds of the country again next week in such a dramatic fashion as he did to cause us to miss a week. So, yeah, keep the flag of liberty flying. Grr, 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 grr. Grrrr.